Alfred was recovering. He was still sick, but he saw God's favour in his son's recovery, and it never occurred to him that it had been pagan magic that caused the recovery. Even Aelswith was generous, and when I asked her for the loan of her silver fox fur cloak and what few jewels she possessed, she yielded them without fuss. The fur cloak was dirty, but Bainflid brushed and combed it. There were over 20 men on our island now, probably enough to capture Æthelingaeg from its sullen headman, but Alfred did not want the marshmen killed. They were his subjects, he said, and if the Danes attacked, they might yet fight for us, which meant the large island and its village must be taken by trickery. And so, a week after Edward's rebirth, I took Leofric and Isolde south to Haswold's settlement. Isolde was dressed in the silver fur, and had a silver chain in her hair, and a great garnet brooch at her breast. I'd brushed her hair till it shone, and in that winter's gloom she looked like a princess come from the bright sky. Leofric and I, dressed in mail and helmets, did nothing except walk around Æthelingaeg. But after a while a man came from Haswold and said the chieftain wished to talk with us. I think Haswold expected us to go to his stinking hut, but I demanded he come to us instead. He could have taken from us whatever he wanted, of course, for there were only the three of us, and he had his men, including Eofor the archer. But Haswold had at last understood that dire things were happening in the world beyond the swamp, and that those events could pierce even his watery fastness, and so he chose to talk. He came to us at the settlement's northern gate, which was nothing more than a sheep hurdle propped against decaying fish traps, and there, as I expected, he gazed at Isolde as though he had never seen a woman before. His small cunning eyes flickered at me, and back at her.
"Who is she?" he asked.
"A companion," I said carelessly. I turned to look at the sudden steep hill across the river, where I wanted the fort made.
"Is she your wife?"
Haswold asked. "Companion," I said again. "Have a dozen like her," I added.
"I will pay you for it,"
Haswold said. A score of men were behind him, but only Eofor was armed with anything more dangerous than an eel spear. I turned Isolde to face him. Then I stood behind her and put my hands over her shoulders and undid the big garnet brooch. She shivered slightly, and I whispered that she was safe, and when the brooch pin slid out of the heavy hide, I pulled her fur cloak apart. I showed her nakedness to Haswold, and he dribbled into his fish-scaled beard, and his dirty fingers twitched in his foul otterskin furs. And then I closed the cloak, and let Isolde fasten the brooch.
"How much will you pay me?" I asked him.
"I can't just take her,"
Haswold said, jerking his head at his men. I smiled at that.
"You could," I said, "but many of you will die before we die, and our ghosts will come back to kill your women and make your children scream. Have you not heard that we have a witch with us? You think your weapons can fight magic?"
None of them moved.
"I have silver,"
Haswold said.
"I don't need silver," I said. "What I want is a bridge and a fort."
I turned and pointed to the hill across the river.
"What's that hill called?"
He shrugged.
"The hill,"
he said.
"Just the hill?"
"It must become a fort," I said. "And it must have walls of logs, and a gate of logs, and a tower so that men can see a long way down river. And then I want a bridge leading to the fort, a bridge strong enough to stop ships."
"You want to stop ships?"
Haswold asked. He scratched his groin and shook his head.
"Can't build a bridge."
"Why not?"
"Too deep."
That was probably true. It was low tide now, and the Pedradon flowed sullenly between steep and deep mud banks.
"But I can't block the river,"
Haswold went on, his eyes still on Isolde.
Block the river, I said, and build a fort.
Give her to me, Haswell promised. And you will have both.
Do what I want, I said, and you can have her, her sisters, and her cousins. All 12 of them. Haswald would have drained the whole swamp and built a new Jerusalem for the chance to hump his ult, but he'd not thought beyond the end of his prick. But that was far enough for me, and I've never seen work done so quickly. It was done in days. He blocked the river first, and did it cleverly by making a floating barrier of logs and felled trees, complete with their tangling branches, all of them lashed together with goat-hide ropes. A ship's crew could eventually dismantle such a barrier, but not if they were being assailed by spears and arrows from the fort on the hill that had a wooden palisade, a flooded ditch, and a flimsy tower made of alder logs bound together with leather ropes. It was all crude work, but the wall was solid enough, and I began to fear that the small fort would be finished before enough West Saxons arrived to garrison it. But the three priests were doing their job, and the soldiers still came. And I put a score of them in Æthelingaeg, and told them to help finish the fort. When the work was done, or nearly done, I took Isolt back to Æthelingaeg, and I dressed her as she had been dressed before. Only this time, she wore a deerskin tunic beneath the precious fur. And I stood her in the centre of the village, and said Haswald could take her. He looked at me warily, then looked at her.
"She's mine," he asked.
"All yours," I said, and stepped away from her.
"And her sisters?"
he asked greedily.
"Her cousins?"
"I shall bring them tomorrow." He beckoned Isolt towards his hut.
"Come,"
he said. "In her country," I said, "it's the custom for the man to lead the woman to his bed." He stared at Isolt's lovely, dark-eyed face above the swathing silver cloak. I stepped further back, abandoning her, and he darted forward, reaching for her. And she brought her hands out from under the thick fur, and she was holding Wasp-Sting, and its blade sliced up into Haswald's belly. She gave a cry of horror and surprise as she brought the blade up, and I saw her hesitate. Shocked by the effort required to pierce a man's belly, and by the reality of what she had done. Then she gritted her teeth and ripped the blade hard, opening him up like a gutted carp. And he gave a strange mewing cry as he staggered back from her vengeful eyes. His intestines spilled into the mud, and I was beside her then with serpent breath drawn. She was gasping, trembling. She had wanted to do it, but I doubted she would want to do it again.
"You are asked," I snarled at the villagers, "to fight for your king."
Haswald was on the ground twitching, his blood soaking his otterskin clothes. He made a mewing noise again, and one of his filthy hands scrabbled among his own spilt guts.
"For your king," I repeated. "When you are asked to fight for your king, it is not a request, but a duty. Every man here is a soldier. And your enemy is the Danes. And if you'll not fight them, then you'll fight against me."
Isolt still stood beside Haswald, who jerked like a dying fish. I edged her away and stabbed Serpent Breath down to slit his throat.
"Take his head," she told me.
"His head?"
"Strong magic."
We mounted Haswald's head on the fort wall, so that it stared towards the Danes. And in time, 8 more heads appeared there. They were the heads of Haswald's chief supporters, murdered by the villagers, who were glad to be rid of them. Eofa, the archer, was not one of them. He was a simpleton, incapable of speaking sense, though he grunted, and from time to time made howling noises. He could be led by a child, but when asked to use his bow, he proved to have a terrible strength and uncanny accuracy. He was Æthelingaeg's hunter, capable of dropping a full-grown boar at 100 paces, and that was what his name meant, Boar. I left Leofric to command the garrison at Æthelingaeg, and took Isolt back to Alfred's refuge.
She was silent, and I thought her sunk in misery. But then she suddenly laughed.
Look!
She pointed at the dead man's blood, matted and sticky in Aelswith's fur. She still had Waspsting. That was my short sword, a sax, and it was a wicked blade in a close fight where men are so crammed together that there's no room to swing a longsword or an axe. She trailed the blade in the water, then used the hem of Aelswith's fur to scrub the diluted blood from the steel.
"It's harder than I thought," she said, "to kill a man."
"It takes strength."
"But I have his soul now."
"Is that why you did it?"
"To give life," she said. "You must take it from somewhere else."
She gave me back Waspsting. Alfred was shaving when we returned. He'd been growing a beard, not for a disguise, but because he'd been too low in spirits to bother about his appearance. But when Isolde and I reached his refuge, he was standing naked to the waist beside a big wooden tub of heated water. His chest was pathetically thin, his belly hollow. But he had washed himself, combed his hair, and was now scratching at his stubble with an ancient razor he had borrowed from a marshman. His daughter, Æthelflæd, was holding a scrap of silver that served as a mirror. "I'm feeling better," he told me solemnly. "Good Lord," I said. "So am I."
"Does that mean you've killed someone?"
"She did." I jerked my head at his alt. He gave her a speculative look.
"My wife,"
he said, dipping the razor in the water,
"was asking whether Isolde is truly a queen."
"She was," I said, "but that means little in Cornwallum. She was queen of a dung heap."
"And she's a pagan?"
"It was a Christian kingdom," I said. "Well, didn't Brother Asser tell you that?"
"He said they were not good Christians."
"Well, I thought that was for God to judge."
"Good, Uhtred. Good."
He waved the razor at me, then stooped to the silver mirror and scraped at his upper lip.
"Can she foretell the future?"
"She can." He scraped in silence for a few heartbeats. Æthelflæd watched Isolde solemnly.
"So tell me,"
Alfred said.
"Does she say I will be king in Wessex again?"
"You will,"
Isolde said tonelessly, surprising me. Alfred stared at her.
"My wife," he said, "says that we can look for a ship now that Edward is better. Look for a ship. Go to Francia and perhaps travel on to Rome. There is a Saxon community in Rome."
He scraped the blade against his jawbone.
"They will welcome us."
"The Danes will be defeated,"
Isolde said, still tonelessly, but without a quiver of doubt in her voice. Alfred rubbed his face.
"The example of Boethius tells us she's right," he said.
"Boethius?" I asked. "Is he one of your warriors?"
"He was a Roman, Uhtred,"
Alfred said, in a tone which chided me for not knowing.
"And a Christian, and a philosopher, and a man rich in book learning. Rich indeed."
He paused, contemplating the story of Boethius.
"When the pagan Alaric overran Rome," he went on, "and all civilization and true religion seemed doomed, Boethius alone stood against the sinners. He suffered, but he won through. And we can take heart from him. Indeed we can."
He pointed the razor at me.
"We must never forget the example of Boethius, Uhtred. Never."
"I won't, Lord," I said. "But do you think book learning will get you out of here?"
"I think," he said, "that when the Danes are gone, I shall grow a proper beard."
"Thank you, my sweet."
This last was to Æthelflæd.
"Give the mirror back to Æthelflæd, will you?"
Æthelflæd ran off, and Alfred looked at me with some amusement.
"Does it surprise you that my wife and Æthelflæd have become friends?"
"I'm glad of it, Lord."
"So am I."
"Does your wife know Æthelflæd's trade?" I asked.
"Not exactly,"
he said.
She believes Aenfled was a cook in a tavern. Which is true enough. So, we have a fort at Æthelingigh.
We do. Leofric commands there and has 43 men.
And we have 28 here. The very hosts of Midian.
He was evidently amused.
So, we shall move there?
Well, maybe in a week or two.
Why wait?
He asked.
I shrugged. Well, this place is deeper in the swamp. When we have more men, when we know we can hold Æthelingigh, that's the time for you to go there. He pulled on a grubby shirt.
Your new fort can't stop the Danes?
It'll slow them, Lord. But they could still struggle through the marsh. They'd find it difficult, though, for Leofric was digging ditches to defend Æthelingigh's western edge.
You're telling me Æthelingigh is more vulnerable than this place?
Yes, Lord.
Which is why I must go there, he said. Men can't say their king skulked in an unreachable place, can they?
He smiled at me.
They must say he defied the Danes, that he waited where they could reach him, that he put himself into danger.
And his family? I asked.
And his family,
he said firmly. He thought for a moment.
If they come in force, they could take all the swamp. Isn't that true?
Yes, Lord.
So no place is safer than another. But how large a force does Svein have?
I don't know, Lord.
Don't know?
It was a reproof. Gentle enough, but still a reproof. I haven't got close to them, Lord, I explained. Because till now we've been too weak to resist them. And so long as they leave us undisturbed, then so long do we leave them undisturbed. There's no point in kicking a wild bee's nest, not unless you're determined to get the honey. He nodded acceptance of that argument.
But we need to know how many bees there are, don't we?
He said.
So tomorrow we shall take a look at our enemy. You and me, Uhtred.
No, Lord, I said firmly. I shall go. You shouldn't risk yourself.
That is exactly what I need to do, he said. And men must know I do it, for I am the king. And why would men want a king who does not share their danger?
He waited for an answer, but I had none.
So let's say our prayers,
he finished.
Then we shall eat.
It was fish stew. It was always fish stew. And next day, we went to find the enemy. There were six of us. The man who poled the punt, Isolt and I, two of the newly arrived household troops, and Alfred. I tried once again to make him stay behind, but he insisted.
If anyone should stay, he said, it is Isolt.
She comes, I said.
Evidently.
He did not argue, and we all climbed into a large punt and went westwards, and Alfred stared at the birds, thousands of birds. There were coot, moorhen, dabchicks, ducks, grebes and herons, while off to the west, white against the sullen sky, was a cloud of gulls. The marshmen slid as silent and fast through secret channels. There were times when he seemed to be taking us directly into a bank of reeds or grass, yet the shallow craft would slide through into another stretch of open water. The incoming tide rippled through the gaps, bringing fish to the hidden nets and basket traps. Beneath the gulls, far off to the west, I could see the masts of Svein's fleet, which had been dragged ashore on the coast. Alfred saw them too.
Why don't they join Guthrum?
Because Svein doesn't want to take Guthrum's orders, I said.
You know that?
He told me so. Alfred paused, perhaps thinking of my trial in front of the Witan. He gave me a rueful look.
What sort of man is he?
Formidable.
So why hasn't he attacked us here?
I've been wondering the same thing. Svein had missed a golden chance to invade the swamp and hunt Alfred down. So why had he not even tried? Well, because there's easier plunder elsewhere, I suggested. And because he won't do Guthrum's bidding. They're rivals. If Svein takes Guthrum's orders,
Then he acknowledges Guthrum as his king. Alfred stared at the distant masts, which showed as small scratches against the sky. Then I mutely pointed towards a hill that reared steeply from the western water flats, and the marshman obediently went that way. And when the punt grounded, we clambered through thick alders and past some sunken hovels where sullen folk in dirty otter fur watched us pass. The marshman knew no name for the place, except to call it Brant, which meant steep. And it was steep. Steep and high, offering a view southwards to where the Pedradon coiled like a great snake through the swamp's heart. And at the river's mouth, where sand and mud stretched into the Severn Sea, I could see the Danish ships. They were grounded on the far bank of the Pedradon, in the same place that Uber had grounded his ships before meeting his death in battle. From there, Svein could easily row to Ithlingeik, for the river was wide and deep, and he would meet no challenge until he reached the river barrier beside the fort where Leofric waited. I wanted Leofric and his garrison to have some warning if the Danes attacked, and this high hill offered a view of Svein's camp, but was far enough away so that it would not invite an attack from the enemy. "We should make a beacon here," I said to Alfred. "A fire lit here would give Ithlingeik 2 or 3 hours' warning of a Danish attack." He nodded, but said nothing. He stared at the distant ships, but they were too far off to count. He looked pale, and I knew he had found the climb to the summit painful, so now I urged him downhill to where the hovels leaked smoke. "You should rest here, Lord," I told him. "I'm going to count ships, but you should rest." He did not argue, and I suspected his stomach pains were troubling him again. I found a hovel that was occupied by a widow and her 4 children, and I gave her a silver coin and said her king needed warmth and shelter for the day. And I do not think she understood who he was, but she knew the value of a shilling, and so Alfred went into her house and sat by the fire. "Give him broth," I told the widow, whose name was Elweed, "and let him sleep." She scorned that.
"Folk can't sleep while there's work," she said. "There are eels to skin, fish to smoke, nets to mend, traps to weave."
"They can work," I said, pointing to the 2 household troops, and I left them all to Elweed's tender mercies while Isolt and I took the punt southwards. And because the Pendradon's mouth was only 3 or 4 miles away, and because Brant was such a clear landmark, I left the marshman to help skin and smoke eels. We crossed a smaller river, and then pulled through a long mere broken by marram grass, and by now I could see the hill on the Pedradon's far bank, where we had been trapped by Uber, and I told Isolt the story of the fight as I pulled the punt across the shallows. The hull grounded twice, and I had to push it into deeper water, until I realized the tide was falling fast, and so I tied the boat to a rotting stake. Then we walked across a drying waste of mud and sea lavender towards the Pedradon. I had grounded farther from the river than I'd wanted, and it was a long walk into a cold wind, but we could see all we needed once we reached the steep bank at the river's edge. The Danes could also see us. I was not in mail, but I did have my swords, and the sight of me brought men to the further shore, where they hurled insults across the swirling water. I ignored them. I was counting ships, and saw 24 beast-headed boats hauled up on the strip of ground where we had defeated Uber the year before. Uber's burned ships were also there, their black ribs half buried in the sand, where the men capered and shouted their insults. "How many men can you see?" I asked Isolt. There were a few Danes in the half-wrecked remnants of the monastery where Svein had killed the monks, but most were by the boats.
"Just men?"
she asked. "Forget the women and children," I said. There were scores of women, mostly in the small village that was a little way upstream. She did not know the English words for the bigger numbers, so she gave me her estimate by opening and closing her fingers 6 times. 60, I said, and nodded. "At most 70, and there are 24 ships. She frowned, not understanding the point I made. 24 ships, I said. Means an army of what? 800, 900 men? So those 60 or 70 men are the ship guards. And the others? Where are the others? I asked the question of myself, watching as five of the Danes dragged a small boat to the river's edge. They planned to row across and capture us, but I did not intend to stay that long. The others, I answered my own question, have gone south. They've left their women behind and gone raiding. They're burning, killing, getting rich. They're raping Devonshire.
They're coming,
Isolt said, watching the five men clamber into the small boat. You want me to kill them?
You can.
She looked hopeful. No, I said. So let's go. We started back across the long expanse of mud and sand. It looked smooth, but there were runnels cutting through, and the tide had turned, and the sea was sliding back into the land with surprising speed. The sun was sinking, tangling with black clouds, and the wind pushed the flood up the Severn, and the water gurgled and shivered as it filled the small creeks. I turned to see that the five Danes had abandoned their chase and gone back to the western bank, where their fires looked delicate against the evening's fading light.
I can't see the boat,
Isolt said. Over there, I said. But I was not certain I was right, because the light was dimming, and our punt was tied against a background of reeds. And now we were jumping from one dry spot to another, and the tide went on rising, and the dry spots shrank. And then we were splashing through the water, and still the wind drove the tide inland. The tides are big in the Severn. A man could make a house at low tide, and by high tide it would have vanished beneath the waves. Islands appear at low tide, islands with summits 30 feet above the water, and at the high tide, they're gone. And this tide was pushed by the wind, and it was coming fast and cold, and Isolt began to falter, so I picked her up and carried her like a child. I was struggling, and the sun was behind the low western clouds, and it seemed now that I was wading through an endless, chill sea. But then, perhaps because the darkness was falling, or perhaps because Hodder, the blind god of the night, favoured me, I saw the punt straining against its tether. I dropped Isolt into the boat and hauled myself over the low side. I cut the rope, then collapsed, cold and wet and frightened, and let the punt drift on the tide.
You must get back to the fire,
Isolt chided me. I wished I'd brought the marshman now, for I had to find a route across the swamp, and it was a long, cold journey in the day's last light. Isolt crouched beside me and stared far across the waters to where a hill reared up green and steep against the eastern land.
Aenfled told me that hill is Avalon,
she said reverently. Avalon?
Where Arthur's buried.
I thought you believed he was sleeping.
He does sleep, she said fervently. He sleeps in his grave, with his warriors.
She gazed at the distant hill that seemed to glow, because it had been caught by the day's last errant shaft of sunlight, spearing from the west beneath the furnace of glowing clouds.
Arthur, she said in a whisper, he was the greatest king who ever lived. He had a magic sword.
She told me tales of Arthur, how he had pulled his sword from a stone, and how he'd led the greatest warriors to battle. And I thought that his enemies had been us, the English Saxons. Yet Avalon was now in England, and I wondered if, in a few years, the Saxons would recall their lost kings and claim they were great, and all the while the Danes would rule us. When the sun vanished, Isolt was singing softly in her own tongue. But she told me the song was about Arthur, and how he had placed a ladder against the moon, and netted a swathe of stars to make a cloak for his queen, Guinevere. Her voice carried us across the twilit water, sliding between reeds, and behind us the fires of the Danish shipguards faded in the encroaching dark, and far off a dog howled, and the wind sighed cold, and a spattering of rain shivered the black mere. Isolt stopped singing as Brant loomed.
"There's going to be a great fight,"
she said softly. And her words took me by surprise, and I thought she was still thinking of Arthur, and imagining that the sleeping king would erupt from his earthy bed in gouts of soil and steel.
"A fight by a hill,"
she went on.
"A steep hill. And there will be a white horse, and the slope will run with blood, and the Danes will run from the Sais."
"The Sais were us, the Saxons." "You dreamed this?" I asked.
"I dreamed it," she said.
"So it is true?"
"It is fate," she said.
And I believed her. And just then the bow of the punt scraped on the island shore. It was pitch dark, but there were fish-smoking fires on the beach, and by their dying light we found our way to Elweed's house. It was made of alder logs thatched with reeds, and I found Alfred sitting by the central hearth, where he stared absently into the flames. Elweed, the two soldiers and the marshman, were all skinning eels at the hut's further end, where three of the widow's children were plaiting willow withies into traps, and the fourth was gutting a big pike. I crouched by the fire, wanting its warmth to bring life to my frozen legs. Alfred blinked as though he was surprised to see me.
"The Danes?"
he asked. "Gone inland," I said. "Left 60 or 70 men as shipguards." I crouched by the fire, shivering, wondering if I would ever be warm again.
"There's food here,"
Alfred said vaguely. "Good," I said, "because we're starving."
"No, I mean there's food in the marshes," he said. "Enough food to feed an army." "We can raid them, Uhtred. Gather men and raid them." "But that isn't enough." "I have been thinking. All day I've been thinking."
He looked better now, less pained, and I suspected he had wanted time to think, and had found it in this stinking hovel.
"I'm not going to run away," he said firmly. "I'm not going to Francia."
"Good," I said, though I was so cold I was not really listening to him.
"We're going to stay here," he said. "Raise an army and take Wessex back."
"Good," I said again. I could smell burning. The hearth was surrounded by flat stones, and Elweed had put a dozen oat bannocks on the stones to cook, and the edges nearest the flames were blackening. I moved one of them, but Alfred frowned and gestured for me to stop for fear of distracting him.
"The problem," he said, "is that I cannot afford to fight a small war."
I did not see what other war he could fight, but kept silent.
"The longer the Danes stay here," he said, "the firmer their grip. Men will start giving Guthrum their allegiance. I can't have that."
"No, Lord."
"So they have to be defeated."
He spoke grimly.
"Not beaten, Uhtred, but defeated."
I thought of Isolt's dream, but said nothing. Then I thought how often Alfred had made peace with the Danes instead of fighting them, and still I said nothing.
"In spring," he went on, "they'll have new men, and they'll spread through Wessex until by summer's end there'll be no Wessex. So we have to do two things."
He was not so much telling me as just thinking aloud.
"First,"
he held out one long finger,
"we have to stop them from dispersing their armies. They have to fight us here. They have to be kept together so they can't send small bands across the country and take estates."
Well, that made sense. Right now, from what we'd heard from the land beyond the swamp, the Danes were raiding all across Wessex. But they were going fast, snatching what plunder they could before other men could take it. But in a few weeks they would start looking for places to live. By keeping their attention on the swamp, Alfred hoped to stop that process.
"And while they look at us," he said, "the feared must be gathered."
I stared at him. I'd suppose he would stay in the swamp until the Danes either overwhelmed us or we gained enough strength to take back a shire, and then another shire. A process of years. But his vision was much grander.
He would assemble the army of Wessex under the Danish noses, and take everything back at once. It was like a game of dice, and he had decided to take everything he had, little as it was, and risk it all on one throw. "We shall make them fight a great battle," he said grimly. "And with God's help, we shall destroy them." There was a sudden scream. Alfred, as if startled from a reverie, looked up, but too late, because Elwed was standing over him, screaming that he had burned the oat cakes.
"I told you to watch them!"
she shouted, and in her fury she slapped the king with a skinned eel. The blow made a wet sound as it struck, and had enough force to knock Alfred sideways. The two soldiers jumped up, hands going to their swords, but I waved them back as Elwed snatched the burned cakes from the stones.
"I told you to watch them!"
she shrieked. And Alfred lay where he had fallen, and I thought he was crying. But then I saw he was laughing. He was helpless with laughter, weeping with laughter, as happy as ever I saw him. Because he had a plan to take back his kingdom. Ethelingaeg's garrison now had 73 men. Alfred moved there with his family, and sent 6 of Leofric's men to Brant, armed with axes and orders to make a beacon. He was at his best in those days, calm and confident, the panic and despair of the first weeks of January swept away by his irrational belief that he would regain his kingdom before summer touched the land. He was immensely cheered, too, by the arrival of Father Beocca, who came limping from the landing stage, face beaming, to fall prostrate at the king's feet.
"You live, Lord!"
Beocca said, clutching the king's ankles.
"God be praised, you live!"
Alfred raised him and embraced him, and both men wept. And next day, a Sunday, Beocca preached a sermon which I could not help hearing because the service was held in the open air, under a clear, cold sky, and Ethelingaeg's island was too small to escape the priest's voice. Beocca said how David, king of Israel, had been forced to flee his enemies, how he had taken refuge in the cave of Adullam, and how God had led him back into Israel, and to the defeat of his enemies.
"This is our Adullam,"
Beocca said, waving his good hand at Ethelingaeg's thatched roofs.
"And this is our David."
He pointed to the king.
"And God will lead us to victory."
"Oh, it's a pity, father," I said to Beocca afterwards, "that you weren't this belligerent 2 months ago."
"I rejoice," he said loftily, "to find you in the king's good graces."
"Oh, he's discovered the value," I said, "of murderous bastards like me. So perhaps he'll learn to distrust the advice of snivelling bastards like you, who told him the Danes could be defeated by prayer." He sniffed at that insult, then looked disapprovingly at Isolt.
"You have news of your wife?"
"None." Beocca had some news, though none of Mildred. He had fled south in front of the invading Danes, getting as far as Dornwarasester in Thornsita, where he had found refuge with some monks. The Danes had come, but the monks had received warning of their approach, and had hidden in an ancient fort that lay near the town. The Danes had sacked Dornwarasester, taking silver, coins, and women. Then they had moved eastwards, and shortly after that, Hupper, the Ealdorman of Thornsita, had come to the town with 50 warriors. Hupper had set the monks and townspeople to mending the old Roman walls.
"The folk there are safe for the moment," Beocca told me. "But there is not sufficient food if the Danes return and lay siege."
Then Beocca had heard that Alfred was in the great swamps, and Beocca had travelled alone, though on his last day of walking he had met 6 soldiers going to Alfred, and so he had finished his journey with them. He brought no news of Wulf here. But he had been told that Odda the Younger was somewhere on the upper reaches of the Usk, in an ancient fort built by the old people. Beocca had seen no Danes on his journey.
"They raid everywhere," he said gloomily. "But God be praised, we saw none of them." Is Dornwer Ancestor a large place? I asked.
Large enough. It had 3 fine churches.
3? A market?
Indeed. It was prosperous before the Danes came.
Yet the Danes didn't stay there.
Nor were they at Giffel, he said. And that's a goodly place.
Guthrum had surprised Alfred, defeated the forces at Sippenham and driven the king into hiding. But to hold Wessex he needed to take all her walled towns. And if Bjorka could walk 3 days across country and see no Danes, then it suggested Guthrum did not have the men to hold all he had taken. He could bring more men from Mercia or East Anglia, but then those places might rise against their weakened Danish overlords. So Guthrum had been hoping that more ships would come from Denmark. In the meantime, we learned, he had garrisons in Bartham, Redingham, Meileborg, and Andaferra. And doubtless he held other places. And Alfred suspected, rightly, as it turned out, that most of eastern Wessex was in Danish hands. But great stretches of the country were still free of the enemy. Guthrum's men were making raids into those stretches, but they did not have sufficient force to garrison towns like Wintoncester, Giffel, or Dornwerecester. In the early summer, Alfred knew, more ships would bring more Danes, so he had to strike before then. To which end, on the day after Bjorka arrived, he summoned a council. There were now enough men on Ethelingaeg for a royal formality to prevail. I no longer found Alfred sitting outside a hut in the evening, but instead had to seek an audience with him. On the Monday of the council, he gave orders that a large house was to be made into a church, and the family that lived there was evicted, and some of the newly arrived soldiers were ordered to make a great cross for the gable and to carve new windows in the walls. The council itself met in what had been Haswald's hall, and Alfred had waited till we were assembled before making his entrance, and we had all stood as he came in, and waited as he took one of the 2 chairs on the newly made dais. Aelswith sat beside him, her pregnant belly swathed in the silver fur cloak that was still stained with Haswald's blood. We were not allowed to sit until the Bishop of Exoncester said a prayer, and that took time, but at last the king waved us down. There were 6 priests in the half-circle and 6 warriors. I sat beside Leofric, while the other 4 soldiers were newly arrived men, who had served in Alfred's household troops. One of those was a grey-bearded man called Egwine, who told me he had led 100 men at Esk's Hill, and plainly thought he should now lead all the troops gathered in the swamp. I knew he had urged his case with the king, and with Bjorka, who sat just below the dais at a rickety table, on which he was trying to record what was said at the council. Bjorka was having difficulties, for his ink was ancient and faded, his quill kept splitting, and his parchments were wide margins torn from a missal, so he was unhappy. But Alfred liked to reduce arguments to writing. The king formally thanked the bishop for his prayer, then announced, sensibly enough, that we could not hope to deal with Guthrum until Svein was defeated. Svein was the immediate threat, for though most of his men had gone south to raid Defnashir, he still had the ships with which to enter the swamp.
24 ships?
Alfred said, raising an eyebrow at me. 24, lord, I confirmed.
So, when his men are assembled, he can muster near 1,000 men.
Alfred let that figure linger a while. Bjorka frowned as his split quills spattered ink on his tiny patch of parchment.
But a few days ago, Alfred went on, there were only 70 ship guards at the mouth of the Pedraddon.
Around 70, I said. There could be more we didn't see.
Fewer than 100, though.
I suspect so, lord.
So we must deal with them, Alfred said, before the rest return to their ships.
There was another silence. All of us knew how weak we were. A few men arrived every day, like the half-dozen who had come with Bjorka, but they came slowly, either because the news of Alfred's existence was spreading slowly, or else because the weather was cold, and men do not like to travel on wet, cold days. Nor were there any thanes among the newcomers. Not one. Thanes were noblemen, men of property, men who could bring scores of well-armed followers to a fight, and every shire had its thanes who ranked just below the reeve and eldermen, who were themselves thanes. Thanes were the power of Wessex, but none had come to Ethelingake. Some, we heard, had fled abroad, while others tried to protect their property. Alfred, I was certain, would have felt more comfortable if he had a dozen thanes about him, but instead he had me, and Leofric, and Egwine. "What are our forces now?" Alfred asked us.
"We have over 100 men," Egwine said brightly.
"Of whom only 60 or 70 are fit to fight," I said. "There have been an outbreak of sickness, men vomiting and shivering and hardly able to control their bowels. Whenever troops gather, such sickness seems to strike."
"Is that enough?"
Alfred asked.
"Enough for what, lord?"
Egwine was not quick-witted.
"Enough to get rid of Svein, of course,"
Alfred said. And again there was silence, because the question was absurd. Then Egwine straightened his shoulders.
"More than enough, lord."
Aelswyth bestowed a smile on him.
"And how would you propose doing it?"
Alfred asked.
"Take every man we have, lord," Egwine said. "Every fit man, and attack them. Attack them!"
Beoka was not writing. He knew when he was hearing nonsense, and he was not going to waste scarce ink on bad ideas. Alfred looked at me.
"Can it be done?"
"They'll see us coming," I said. "They'll be ready."
"March inland," Egwine said. "Come from the hills."
Again Alfred looked at me. "Well, that will leave Ethelingake undefended," I said, "and it will take at least 3 days, at the end of which our men will be cold, hungry, and tired, and the Danes will see us coming when we emerge from the hills, and that'll give them time to put on armour and gather weapons, and at best it will be equal numbers. At worst..." I just shrugged. After 3 or 4 days, the rest of Svein's forces might have returned, and our 70 or 80 men would be facing a horde.
"So how do you do it?"
Alfred asked. "We destroy their boats," I said.
"Go on."
"Without boats," I said, "they can't come up the rivers. Without boats, they're stranded." Alfred nodded. Beoka was scratching away again.
"So how do you destroy the boats?"
the king asked. I did not know. We could take 70 men to fight their 70, but at the end of the fight, even if we won, we would be lucky to have 20 men still standing. Those 20 could burn the boats, of course, but I doubted we would survive that long. There were scores of Danish women at Sinuit, and if it came to a fight, they would join in, and the odds were that we would be defeated.
"Fire," Egwine said enthusiastically. "Carry fire in punts and throw the fire from the river."
"There are ship guards," I said tiredly, "and they'll be throwing spears and axes, sending arrows, and you might burn one boat, but that's all."
"Go at night,"
Egwine said. "It's almost a full moon," I said, "and they'll see us coming, and if the moon is clouded, we won't see their fleet."
"So how do you do it?"
Alfred demanded again.
"God will send fire from heaven,"
Bishop Aelwold said, and no one responded. Alfred stood. We all got to our feet. Then he pointed at me.
"You will destroy Svein's fleet," he said, "and I would know how you plan to do it by this evening. If you cannot do it, then you," he pointed to Egwine, "will travel to Devonshire, find Elderman Odder and tell him to bring his forces to the river mouth and do the job for us."
"Yes, lord,"
Egwine said.
"By tonight,"
Alfred said to me coldly, and then he walked out. He left me angry. He had meant to leave me angry. I stalked up to the newly made fort with Leofric and stared across the marshes to where the clouds heaped above the Severn.
"How are we to burn 24 ships?"
I demanded.
God will send fire from heaven, Leofric said. Of course.
I'd rather he sent 1,000 troops.
Alfred won't summon Odder, Leofric said. He just said that to annoy you.
But he's right, isn't he? I said grudgingly. We have to get rid of Svein.
How?
I stared at the tangled barricade that Haswald had made from felled trees. The water, instead of flowing downstream, was coming upstream because the tide was on the flood, and so the ripples ran eastwards from the tangled branches.
I remember a story, I said, from when I was a small child.
I paused, trying to recall the tale, which I assume had been told to me by Beoka. The Christian god divided a sea.
Isn't that right?
Moses did, Leofric said.
And when the enemy followed, I said, they were drowned.
Clever, Leofric said.
So that's how we'll do it, I said.
How?
But instead of telling him, I summoned the marshmen and talked with them. And by that night I had my plan. And because it was taken from the scriptures, Alfred approved it readily. It took another day to get everything ready. We had to gather sufficient punts to carry 40 men, and I also needed Eofor, the simple-minded archer. He was unhappy, not understanding what I wanted, and he gibbered at us and looked terrified. But then a small girl, perhaps 10 or 11 years old, took his hand and explained that he had to go hunting with us.
"He trusts you?" I asked the child.
"He's my uncle," she said.
Eofor was holding her hand, and he was calm again.
"Does Eofor do what you tell him?"
She nodded, her small face serious, and I told her she must come with us to keep her uncle happy. We left before the dawn. We were 20 marshmen, skilled with boats, 20 warriors, a simple-minded archer, a child, and Isolt. Alfred, of course, did not want me to take Isolt, but I ignored him, and he did not argue. Instead, he watched us leave, then went to Æthelingaeg's church that now boasted a newly made cross of alderwood nailed to its gable. And low in the sky, above the cross, was the full moon. She was low and ghostly pale, and as the sun rose, she faded even more. But as the 10 punts drifted down the river, I stared at her and said a silent prayer to Hodder, because the moon is his woman, and it was she who must give us victory. Because, for the first time since Guthrum had struck in a winter's dawn, the Saxons were fighting back.
Chapter 8.
Before the Pedradon reaches the sea, it makes a great curve through the swamp. A curve that is almost 3/4 of a circle, and on the inside of the bank, where the curve begins, there was another tiny settlement. Just a 6 hovels built on stilts, sunk into a slight rise in the ground. The settlement was called Palfleet, which means the place with the stakes. For the folk who had once lived there had staked eel and fish traps in the nearby streams, but the Danes had driven those folk away and burned their houses, so that Palfleet was now a place of charred pilings and blackened mud. We landed there, shivering in the dawn. The tide was falling, exposing the great banks of sand and mud, across which Isolt and I had struggled, while the wind was coming from the west, cold and fresh, hinting of rain, though for now there was a slanting sunlight throwing long shadows of marram grass and reeds across the marshes. 2 swans flew south, and I knew they were a message from the gods. But what their message was I could not tell. The punts pushed away, abandoning us. They were now going north and east, following intricate waterways known only to the marshmen. We stayed for a while in Palfleet, doing nothing in particular, but doing it energetically, so that the Danes, a long way off across the great bend in the river, would be sure to see us. We pulled down the blackened timbers, and Isolt,
who had acute eyesight, watched the place where the Danish ship's masts showed as scratches against the western clouds.
"There's a man up a mast," she said after a while.
And I stared, saw the man clinging to the mast top, and knew we had been spotted. The tide was falling, exposing more mud and sand, and now that I was sure we had been seen, we walked across the drying expanse that was cradled by the river's extravagant bend. As we drew closer, I could see more Danes in their ship's rigging. They were watching us, but would not yet be worried, for they outnumbered my few forces, and the river lay between us and them. But whoever commanded in the Danish camp would also be ordering his men to arm themselves. He would want to be ready for whatever happened, but I also hoped he would be clever. I was laying a trap for him, and for the trap to work, he had to do what I wanted him to do, but at first, if he was clever, he would do nothing. He knew we were impotent, separated from him by the Pedradon, and so he was content to watch as we closed on the river's bank opposite his grounded ships, and then slipped and slid down the steep muddy bluff that the ebbing tide had exposed. The river swirled in front of us, grey and cold. There were close to 100 Danes watching now. They were on their grounded boats, shouting insults. Some were laughing, for it seemed clear to them that we had walked a long way to achieve nothing. But that was because they did not know Eofa's skills. I called the big bowman's niece to my side. "What I want your Uncle Eofa to do," I explained to the small girl, "is kill some of those men."
"Kill them?"
She stared up at me with wide eyes. "They're bad men," I said, "and they want to kill you." She nodded solemnly, then took the big man by the hand and led him to the water's edge, where he sank up to his calves in the mud. It was a long way across the river, and I wondered pessimistically if it was too far for even his massive bow. But Eofa strung the great stave and then waded into the Pedradon until he found a shallow spot, which meant he could go even farther into the river. And there he took an arrow from his sheath, put it on the string, and hauled it back. He made a grunting noise as he released, and I watched the arrow twitch off the cord. Then the fledgling caught the air, and the arrow soared across the stream and plunged into a group of Danes standing on the steering platform of a ship. There was a cry of anger as the arrow cut down. It did not hit any of the group, but Eofa's next arrow struck a man in his shoulder, and the Danes hurried back from their vantage point by the ship's sternpost. Eofa, who was compulsively nodding his shaggy head and making small animal noises, turned his aim to another ship. He had extraordinary strength. The distance was too great for any accuracy, but the danger of the long, white-fledged arrows drove the Danes back, and it was our turn to jeer at them. One of the Danes fetched a bow and tried to shoot back, but his arrow sliced into the river 20 yards short, and we taunted them, laughed at them, and capered up and down as Eofa's arrow slammed into ship's timbers. Only the one man had been wounded, but we had driven them backwards, and that was humiliating to them. I let Eofa loose 20 arrows, then I waded into the river and took hold of his bow. I stood in front of him so the Danes could see what I was doing. "Tell him not to worry," I told the girl, and she soothed Eofa, who was frowning at me and trying to remove his bow from my grasp. I drew a knife, and that alarmed him even more. He growled at me, then plucked the bow from my hand. "Tell him it's all right," I told the girl. And she soothed her uncle, who then let me half-sever the woven hemp bowstring. I stepped away from him and pointed at a group of Danes. "Kill them," I said. Eofa did not want to draw the bow. Instead, he fumbled under his greasy woolen cap and produced a second bowstring, but I shook my head, and the small girl persuaded him he must use the half-severed cord, and so he pulled it nervously back, and just before it reached the full draw, the string snapped, and the arrow span crazily into the sky to float away on the river. The tide had turned, and the water was rising.
"We go!"
I shouted to my men.